The president now says he's open to appointing an Ebola czar. This hour, how Iowa's largest hospital is preparing to face the deadly disease. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the first half hour, infectious disease specialist Dr. Michael Edmond of the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics gives us his reaction to our nation's flawed response to Ebola so far, and how his hospital is preparing for the possibility of Ebola coming to Iowa. Then we'll get an update from Iowan Kayla Cassavant, who lives and works in Liberia. And Elwin Taylor tells us about harvest progress and the long-range weather forecast. Your Friday News Buzz after this news from NPR. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We're going to dive right in with one of the top stories in our news this week. In just a moment, of course, Ebola, that news. Many developments over the past few days on that story nationwide and worldwide. In just a few moments, we're going to be talking with an Iowan who is still living and working in Liberia, one of the main countries affected by the Ebola outbreak. But first, let's stay stateside. At a congressional hearing yesterday, federal health officials faced sharp questioning about the flawed handling of Ebola cases here in the United States. This after the latest news that a nurse infected with Ebola at a Dallas hospital would be transferred to a specialized unit at the National Institutes of Health in Maryland. The hospital is straining its efforts to monitor dozens of other healthcare workers who may have been exposed to the virus. Joining us now to talk about the latest developments surrounding the Ebola outbreak, Dr. Michael Edmond. He's Chief Quality Officer at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics in Iowa City, also Professor of Infectious Diseases. Dr. Edmond, welcome to our program.
Thank you.
As this Ebola story has unfolded over the past few days, many of us in the United States, in the state of Iowa, have gone from, well, having confidence in our nation's ability to keep Ebola from posing a threat to wondering if our health officials and the procedures in place are up to the task. How do you see what's been going on?
Well, I think we're on a learning curve with what we've seen over the past few weeks. And hospitals across the United States are responding to that. I think they're working very hard to ensure that they have appropriate training and protocols in place so that should a patient present to their hospital, they'll be able to manage them safely.
Mm-hmm. How would you characterize the mistakes? And it is being characterized as a flawed handling. What specifically have been the mistakes up to this point that you can identify?
Well, I think one of the important things is we need to be able to quickly identify patients who may have Ebola and then test them to see whether or not they do indeed. But you want to rapidly consider the diagnosis so that you can get the patient into appropriate isolation and not expose healthcare workers or other patients in the environment to this potentially infected patient. Mm. So that's one issue. The other issue is how to perform the appropriate isolation procedures with regards to how should healthcare workers wear the appropriate equipment so that they are adequately protected from acquiring the virus.
Mm-hmm. How has this Ebola scare and the developments of the past 2 weeks changed the way things are done at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics?
Well, I think one of the big lessons that came from Dallas was that prior to the cases there, we always felt that unprotected exposures for infectious diseases were more risky than those that were protected. In other words, the healthcare worker had all the protection on. And we saw the exact opposite in this case. And this was a big learning lesson for all of us, because what happened here is that early on, when the patient presented to the emergency room and no one was in appropriate protective gear, there was no transmission. But later on, when the patient was very sick and in the ICU, and the healthcare workers had on appropriate gear, there was transmission. And that's because we've learned that as patients get sicker with Ebola, the infectivity increases markedly. These patients become very infectious. And even with appropriate gear, transmission has occurred, most likely because of the difficulties of removing the gear and doing that in a way that you don't then recontaminate yourself.
I just mentioned that this latest nurse infected with Ebola at a Dallas hospital is being transferred to a specialized unit to Maryland at the National Institutes of Health. If there would be a case that would pop up here in Iowa, would that patient now be under a new protocol transferred out of state or perhaps to the University of Iowa hospitals?
Well, I don't think that we at this point know. I think that is under consideration now by CDC as to how these patients should be managed. In other words, initially, you may recall that CDC's stance was any hospital should be able to manage these patients. And what we're seeing now is a movement towards moving patients to very specialized biocontainment units. We have to keep in mind, though, that the number of those beds in the United States is very limited, and if we exceed the capacity of those, other hospitals may be called on to provide this type of care.
Does the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics have these appropriate biocontainment units? Could you handle Ebola patients?
We could handle Ebola patients. We do not have a specific biocontainment unit of the sort that is located at the University of Nebraska or Emory University or the National Institutes of Health. But we are able to provide care for patients with infectious diseases, and we do have all the appropriate personal protective gear to do that.
Are you training personnel at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics right now, retraining them, giving them more training should this eventuality come to pass?
We are. And the problem is that this is a moving target. CDC will be, in short order, revising some of the protocols for personal protective equipment, and we will have to redo our training to be in line with those protocols.
Can you give us a sense of the type of training that's going on currently?
The healthcare workers are being shown videos of what the appropriate process is for how to put the personal protective equipment on and then how to take it back off. And then they are able to practice with the appropriate equipment so that they're able to do it proficiently.
Mm-hmm. Can you give them an idea in round numbers how many personnel at your hospital this is affecting?
Well, it's affecting the personnel who would be the healthcare workers who would see these patients. So in other words, this would be our healthcare providers in the emergency department where patients are most likely to present first, and the unit of the hospital, inside the hospital, where patients who are either suspect or confirmed to have Ebola would be housed once they're admitted to the hospital.
And so we're talking tens or hundreds of personnel being trained?
Probably we're talking hundreds of personnel.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind our listeners, this is Dr. Michael Edmond, Chief Quality Officer at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Remind us, how is Ebola spread? How do we understand that?
Well, it's spread primarily through contact with blood or body fluids of an infected person. It is thought that there is not airborne transmission of this virus in the sense that tuberculosis is transmitted through the air or, for example, chickenpox. But in this case, you come into contact with infected blood secretions or secretions from the patient.
But if, as in this case, people are traveling around in planes, someone sneezes, I mean, a small particle could land on your skin, your lip, in your eye, and that would infect you, right? Could be.
It's possible. However, early on in the course of the disease, the amount of virus in the patient is quite low and probably not enough to infect somebody in the immediate environment. As I mentioned earlier, as patients become more sick, particularly when they become critically ill, and at this point they're typically in an ICU, they become highly infectious.
Dr. Edmond, as a professor of infectious diseases, are you sure we understand enough about the various strains of Ebola to know how to contain it, or are we on a learning curve there? Could we have, or are we possibly making mistakes in understanding its transmission?
Well, I think it is. It is a learning curve. As I've already mentioned, what I thought some of the lessons we've already learned have been. I think the basics of how to control these diseases we've known for a long time, but we are fine-tuning them.
Mm-hmm. What unanswered questions about Ebola and how our nation has been dealing with the cases in the U.S. Are still unanswered in your mind?
First of all, what is the appropriate therapy for these patients? At this point, We don't have any approved antiviral drugs. And so mostly what patients are getting are supportive care, which in the United States we can do very well, replacing electrolytes, monitoring people's blood pressure, all those types of things we do well. I think we're still on a learning curve with, in the end, what will be the best way to isolate the patient with regards to the appropriate protective equipment. And then we've got work to do on with our healthcare workers in terms of how to get them out of the equipment in a way so that they don't contaminate themselves.
University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics is one of the leading teaching hospitals in the country and also in the world. What about the other hospitals in Iowa? Help us understand how they are on a learning curve. Are they also in contact with the CDC? How does this learning take place, trickle down to hospitals, or is that a good way to describe it?
I really can't comment on what the other hospitals in Iowa are doing. We've been pretty busy with our own preparations, and I suspect that all hospitals in the U.S. are preparing to the degree that they can.
Mm-hmm. And your primary contact is with the CDC, the Center for Disease Control.
Well, our primary contact is first with the Iowa Department of Public Health.
Okay. And so there's been a lot of communication there.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What are you looking for in the next couple of weeks? What do you hope to achieve in the next couple of weeks?
Well, I think our first order of business, once the CDC standardizes the protocol for isolation, is getting us up to speed, all of our healthcare workers, on what the new protocol will be. That's going to be the first order of business.
Okay. And you expect that new protocol to come when?
It should be, I would suspect, within the next few days.
Dr. Michael Edmond, Chief Quality Officer at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Doctor, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In this first half, we're focusing on the Ebola outbreak. Yesterday, President Obama authorized the Pentagon to call up military reservists to help fight the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. About 540 U.S. active troops are already posted in the West African country. They're helping the Liberian government, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and other agencies fight the outbreak. Now, President Obama's latest order would permit the Pentagon to call up National Guard troops or military reservists to join the effort. The Pentagon says that could be as many as 4,000 or more American troops, in addition to what's already there. What is their mission? They're helping to build and support Ebola treatment units, run mobile testing labs, and train healthcare workers. This in an all-out effort to contain the deadly virus. Joining me now, Kayla Cassavant, via Skype from the capital of Liberia, from Monrovia. Kayla, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you, Ben.
Hello, Kayla. Nice to talk with you again. The last time we spoke was in late August. To remind our listeners, you're a research associate with a nonprofit called Building Markets in Monrovia, working in the economic sector. It's been weeks since we spoke. I just read a New York Times article from yesterday, a reporter in Monrovia, where you are. The article has the headline, Ebola Nightmare. The entire city is covered with bodies. Describe the part of the city where you live and work. Is it that bad?
The part of the city that I work in, honestly, I don't see any dead bodies. I think, you know, there are probably some areas where it seems like that, but even in the past couple of weeks, it seems like it's gotten better, that you hear less about, you know, I never saw it for myself, but on the radio sometimes you hear about an ambulance coming here or a dead body in the road, but I never actually saw it for myself. And where I am is really in the center of the city, so I guess you wouldn't expect to see so much of that happening here.
Why not? I would expect it to be in the center of the city. When we have reports of hundreds of new cases of Ebola, we have two cases total here in the U.S. so far. The article says hundreds of new cases of Ebola are being reported in the capital, Monrovia, where you are, each week, but you don't see much evidence of that.
No, well, Monrovia is a capital of about 1 million people, so when you think about it, a few hundred really isn't that much for 1 million people. sometimes you see ambulances going by that you assume they're going to get a dead body from a house or something, but other than that, I haven't seen anything.
What other impacts, what are other things are you noticing as the outbreak continues there in Liberia?
The past few weeks, things have actually stabilized a little bit. You see people starting to go back about some of the normal activities, going to the market, going to business, but you also see a lot of people staying home. Most people, if they don't have to go somewhere, then they won't. They'll stay home all day, and less people going to restaurants or going out in the evening. So it's pretty quiet around here, and we still have the curfew at 11 o'clock at night. So things get quiet around 9 o'clock. You don't see much activity. Other than that, I mean, I think the biggest change is just the mood of the population. When you talk to people, it's always on their mind. Most people know of someone, either if it's their family or related to them somehow, that has died or been diagnosed with Ebola. So you can tell just people are on edge, and they're just taking the precautions and praying that this ends soon.
The precautions that we spoke about earlier, washing your hands with a bleach mixture before when you go out in public to go into buildings and so forth?
Right. Yep, that's one of the precautions. Everyone's washing their hands. Also, you know, a custom in Liberia is to shake hands. And now, I mean, people kind of joke about it that this Ebola is really completely stopped that part of their culture because no one will shake hands anymore. You know, they just wave to each other or something, but some people will get really angry if you even start to reach your hand out towards them. People take it very seriously.
Do people keep their distance more? Will you stay out of people's personal space?
Yes. One big change that they made was with the taxis, which I think is really great because before they were having very crowded taxis and you have four people crowded in the back seat every time. And now they limit it to three people. So at least people aren't so crowded together. They're still saying that taxis are, you know, one of the risks for transmission because they aren't disinfected and so many people pass through them. But at least, you know, people try to keep their distance now.
Talking with Iowan Kayla Cassavant via Skype from Monrovia, the capital of Liberia in West Africa, if you've just joined us. Kayla, can you tell if the outbreak has slowed or since this international response began, evidence of it in Monrovia where you are?
Well, in Liberia, the reports that they're giving, the number of cases has actually gone down per week. Though a lot of people think that that's not really an accurate representation, that you know, there are a lot of cases still not being reported and such. But it's really hard to say whether it's gone down or not. I would say it's been pretty much on the same level, but at least it doesn't seem to have gotten a lot worse. I think the arrival of the new treatment centers that are coming now will help a lot with that as well.
Now, you're a research associate with Building Markets, this nonprofit that's in the economic sector in Liberia. Are you working at all with the helping to build these treatment centers? Any involvement there of your organization?
No, our involvement is primarily to assess the situation. So we already have a network of businesses who we've had a relationship with for the past 3 years. About 3,300 businesses in our network throughout Liberia. And we were approached by a few different organizations to start calling these businesses on a regular basis and asking questions about food prices and about their businesses, what impact Ebola has had on them. And also just in general, some questions about their mood and how things have changed. So what we're doing is mostly to provide information for other organizations that are determining what action to take.
So what has been the impact there, the economic impact in Liberia, in Monrovia? It must be huge.
It's not as huge. From the numbers we're seeing so far, it's not as huge as you might think. For starters, a lot of businesses here, you know, we're looking at businesses that employ between 5 and 100 people, so mostly small businesses. And even before the Ebola crisis, there are a lot of constraints to doing business. It's very difficult here. So now what you're seeing is, you know, roughly maybe 10% of businesses have closed down, at least to see what will happen. So they say that, you know, we're closing for now and we'll see what happens. We'll try to reopen. But a lot of them are saying that they don't have customers. Like I said, a lot of people are staying home. So I think just less people are spending money on frivolous things, and that's affecting business and the economy. Employment has gone down quite a bit. So that's sort of the first thing to go if businesses aren't going to close, and they'll first release some of their employees and try to stay open as long as possible. So there are a lot of people without jobs right now.
What is the attitude, Kayla, toward the international help, also toward the Liberian government, in terms of the response to this outbreak?
People are pretty critical of the Liberian government, but that's normal. Also, they're always pretty critical. I would say they just say that they aren't doing enough, nothing too specific. And then for the international response, I'd say people are welcoming it. They are curious to know what exactly is going to happen, you know, especially with the military that were coming. I heard a lot of people asking questions like, why are there military coming? What does this mean? So getting information out as to what these different organizations are really doing is important.
Kayla Cassavant, what about your personal safety in a city where we're hearing reports of hundreds of new Ebola cases diagnosed every week? How concerned are you about your own safety?
I'm concerned, of course. You know, I take precautions every day. I've really limited my activities. I mostly just go to work and go home. At work, I restrict contact with my staff members.
Restrict how the contact?
I don't shake hands, you know, just keeping your distance. You aren't really at risk unless you're touching other people. So, you know, it's not like I'm keeping 10 feet away from everyone, but, you know, just being careful not to touch anyone.
I guess a natural question to ask, your efforts there, it's certainly admirable to help the Liberian people, but you are an American and you could leave any time. A question on my mind is, as I assume many listeners, why are you still there?
Well, yeah, a lot of people have asked me that as well, including my family. And I think it's a very different story when you're here than when you're looking at the news. And I'm not saying that what the news is saying is not correct, but it has a way of showing the truth in a way that, you know, it's it looks scarier than it is. And really, if I felt in danger so much that I needed to leave, I would. There's no one keeping me here forcing me to stay. But I choose to stay because my job is important to me, and I don't feel like the risk is so much that I need to leave.
All right, Kayla, tell us, what are your future plans?
I'm planning to come back to the U.S. hopefully soon, around Christmas time, spend Christmas with my family. And after that, I don't really have any plans yet.
Kayla Cassavant, be safe. We wish you all the best, and keep up with your important work there, Kayla. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you, Ben.
Coming up in just a moment, an Ankeny police officer's unusual line of questioning for a motorist he pulled over turns into a viral video, and we ask, what are the do's and don'ts when you're pulled over by the police? I'll talk with Randall Wilson of the ACLU of Iowa. Then we'll be joined by ISU climatologist Elwin Taylor and ask how much all that rain earlier this week delayed the harvest. Also ask him, take a stab at a longer-range weather forecast. We'll be back in just a minute. River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
In Cedar Falls, I'm Pat Blank.
At the State House, I'm Clay Masters.
In Burlington, I'm John Pemble.
Near Madrid, I'm Rob Dillard, Iowa Public Radio News.
Connecting Iowans statewide, this is Iowa Public Radio News.
The price of gas is falling, and so is demand for hybrid cars.
Right now, I mean, the internal combustion engine is probably the biggest competition to traditional hybrids. You know, something that's 30 miles per gallon is good and an improvement for a lot of consumers, and they just go with that.
What's behind the hybrid squeeze? Later today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
weekdays at 4 p.m. on Iowa Public Radio.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It was police profiling of a different kind a couple weeks ago. Ankeny, Iowa police officer Aaron King, after stopping a car to write a ticket, asks the driver, why is it everybody that plays frisbee golf smokes weed? This, in an apparent attempt to get the motorist to agree to a search of his vehicle. It prompted an apology from Ankeny's police chief. After that video went viral, he called Officer King's bizarre line of questioning ignorant and foolish. The incident is under investigation, but it got us to wondering, what are your rights when you're pulled over? In just a moment, we'll put this question to Randall Wilson, Interim Executive Director of the ACLU of Iowa. Randall Wilson, welcome to our program.
Hello, Ben.
Let's put that question to you after we listen to an extended excerpt of the audio from a video taken by the driver who was pulled over in Ankeny. Let's listen.
Here's your information back.
Thanks.
This is just a written warning. Make sure you have your headlights on.
Yeah, definitely.
You play frisbee golf?
I do a lot, actually. I play out at Heritage.
You do?
My favorite course. Yep.
All right, okay. I need you to answer me a question. Mm-hmm. Why is it everybody that plays frisbee golf smoke weed?
No, it's not everybody. It's just those select few.
No, it's everybody, man. You can't tell me you've never smoked weed before.
I mean, I'm not gonna tell you one way or another.
See, there you go. How much weed do you have in the car today?
I don't.
Nothing at all?
Nothing at all. Nothing on my person.
So if I searched your car, you wouldn't have anything in there at all?
If you searched me right now, I would not have anything on my person.
What about your car?
Nothing in my car.
Okay. All right. You understand you're free to go and everything, but you wouldn't have a problem with me looking through your car?
I actually would, just because I have a disc golf bag doesn't mean that every disc golfer does have weed. So I would, actually.
So you have weed in the car, then, is what you're saying?
No, what I'm saying is I would mind if you searched my car, because you're profiling me based on me being a disc golfer.
No, I just asked you a question, but you admitted that you have smoked weed in the past during our conversation, so that's why I'm asking if you have weed in the car.
What I said was I'm not going to say one way or another whether I have smoked pot.
Okay. Well, that's a yes.
No, it's not. It's saying I have not smoked. It's saying one way or another I have not smoked pot.
So you don't have anything in the car, though, I need to know about?
No. And just so you know, you are being recorded.
That's perfectly fine. So are you, audio and visual.
Perfect.
I just find it curious, you know, like you said, when I asked you that question, why is it everybody that plays frisbee golf smoke weed? And you're like, well, it's not everybody. So you answered my question there. And I asked you if you've ever smoked weed, like you said, you're not going to say either way. So that's a yes to me. Because if you didn't, you would say no, correct?
No.
Okay.
So because I don't trust police officers, so I feel like I don't have to give you an answer.
Okay. All right, well, if you don't have any questions, you're free to go then.
All right, excellent. Hey, thank you very much, officer.
Yep,
I'd just like
safe.
To shake
we'll
your
see
hand.
You later.
Yep, bye-bye.
Now, after this video got quite a bit of attention on the internet, the chief of police in Ankeny issued a statement, and part of it said, in the video taken by an occupant in the vehicle, the officer engages the driver in a line of questioning that is foolish, not representative of the Ankeny Police Department's training of interactions with the public. This verbal exchange did not meet the level of professionalism expected of Ankeny police officers, the words of the chief of police there. Randall Wilson of the ACLU of Iowa, I'm not sure how much you can comment on this specific case, but what do you hear going on here that has to do with rights we have when we're pulled over?
Well, first of all, I hear a young man who did very well in responding to the situation. I'd say he was almost a model. His only perhaps one mistake was to offer excuses, or not so much excuses, but explanations to the officer. Mm-hmm. Regarding why you didn't want to be searched. You don't owe anything like that. And as you can see, the officer will just take that right around and start to work on it in an argument. And people often will then give up and consent to a search, which turns out to be even more of a hassle. My concerns for anybody who is stopped like that would be, first of all, safety, their rights, and avoiding conflict. So they don't need to fail the attitude test, or right or wrong, they may be hauled away or receive some rough treatment. Second, their safety. You see in the video, when you look at it, that the young man keeps his hands pretty still. He's not reaching around here and there in the car. He's not engaging in movements the officer doesn't expect, which could be interpreted as reaching for a weapon or anything like that. I don't think this was an occasion like that, but definitely you have stops that have a whole lot more tension in them when it involves race or heritage or something like that, that where people are already sensitized to the situation. And then you have the way he handled his rights. He asserted them, and he didn't back away. He didn't decide to give them up. So I think
at the same time,
in all, he handled the situation pretty well.
At the same time, being very polite to the officer.
I think that's critical. You don't need any more conflict in these situations than necessary, and you have to be alert for being drawn into an argument. Because people do lose control once they're into an argumentative state. And they may agree to something rashly that they shouldn't agree to or say something. They probably just should have kept their answers short like this gentleman did.
Can you give us any other do's and don'ts, cautionary do's and don'ts
well, don't
when pulled over?
Don't consent to a search.
Ever?
No. No. Don't consent. At the very least, it's going to be a hassle. And you have no duty to consent to a search. The officer has probable cause for a search, then he may ask you or she may ask you, but that search will happen anyway. But
if they have just to understand, if they have probable cause, they don't need your consent.
Right.
Okay, so that's taken care of then.
Yeah, that's taken care of. So they're trying to get a lot of cases in court are people who actually consented to the search. And you sometimes don't know what a passenger has on them. There were passengers in this vehicle, etc. So it's probably not a good idea most of the time to do that. Certainly it will take a long time. You may think it's going to be simple, but they may say we're waiting on the drug-sniffing dog to get out here and stuff like that, and you need to get on with your day.
You said this particular driver was wise in that he didn't do anything with his hands. It didn't appear
right.
to in this video.
Well,
we always hear about staying in the car, not getting out of the car. Is that, we know it's not wise, but is it right. illegal to get out of the car when you're stopped?
Well, it's not illegal, but it's not a good idea. The concern here for an officer is they don't know who they've got on their hands at first. And so for their safety, it's better just to wait for direction. For example, if they ask you for your license, if it's not somewhere that you can reach where the officer can see what you're up to, what your hands are doing, it's probably best to tell them, in order to get the license, I have to get into my glove compartment. And then the officer will tell you to reach in or not.
Mm-hmm.
The officer says, I'll look in there,
mm-hmm.
you know, because there could be a gun in there. So the officer doesn't know.
Right.
So you get these situations, these police shootings lately, where people are on both sides are confused about what's going on. And the situations like in Ferguson, they can escalate way too rapidly for anybody to keep up with.
Now, we heard in that recording, too, that the driver eventually told the officer he was being recorded, and the officer replied quickly that he was recording as well. So what do you think of this trend in terms of civil liberties, protecting yourself by recording interactions with, say, law enforcement?
I think it's a good thing. There are police departments other than Ankeny who do not necessarily record interactions. And it's best to have your own record because the police aren't going to give you theirs, not without some foot dragging or a fight. So it's good when you have the recording because it shows police supervisors, it shows the judge, it shows the public what's really going on in these stops rather than a he said, she said, etc.
Randall Wilson, Interim Executive Director of the ACLU of Iowa. Thank you.
You're welcome, Ben. Thank you.
And with the harvest underway across Iowa and the Midwest, let's finish up this hour by talking with Iowa State University climatologist and professor of ag meteorology, Elwin Taylor, joining us by phone. Hello, Elwin Taylor.
Well, good afternoon. It's good to be with you today.
Great to have you back on the program again. I'm going to ask you, Elwin, to put your crystal ball in regards to the weather aside for the moment. We'll get to that, okay?
All right.
Let's talk about the crops. How much did those cold days of rain earlier in the week delay our harvest?
Well, some of the delay did occur, and it's been about a week worth, maybe for some farms, 2 weeks of delay. However, a few of those fields needed some delay. Others certainly didn't, where there had been some disease in the crop. There had been some areas of the state where the crop had become essentially mature and then was too moist, and we started to get some mold, and that, of course, makes a load of corn, so it doesn't have the value that it would have if it was high-grade corn. And some of the beans got to the edge of where they would start dropping from their pods just because it was getting a little late to harvest them. This wasn't widespread. We're not going to say that this was the big significant thing to the state, but it certainly would to the individual farmer.
Mm-hmm. When the soil is this saturated, after we have a big rain, we've had a day or two to dry out now, but for those of us who aren't farmers, what is the problem when you've got a really soggy field? Is it actually the fact that the soil is saturated or that, for instance, the stalks of corn have too much moisture in them?
Well, both things, and maybe a third situation as well. First, of course, you don't want to get your equipment stuck in the field. But even more important than that in the long run is when you do work on fields, when they're too moist, the soil will compact. And compacted soil really loses its utility as soil sometimes for several years. Even though you can break up the compaction, the soil structure itself has been damaged. And so this is a disadvantage of having to go out in the field when it is on the moist side of what it should be. Of course, also with the moisture that we've had in the fields, bringing the soils to their field capacity and above to what we call saturation, many of the tiles, in fact, most of the reports I've had said our tiles are running this time of year, meaning running off excess water. And in one way, that's good. It means that water will still be in the soil. As soon as the tiles quit running, the soil has all the water it can hold, and it will still be there come spring. The only thing that can remove plant available water from the subsoil is a growing plant.
How is the harvest going overall, Elwin? How much do we have in the bins and silos, drying machines?
The reports are looking good, and that we're on normal for bringing things in. Some of the locations that do crop drying are saying that they're starting to get a bit of a backup. They have to ask their farmers to stagger the things coming in. Other places I'm not hearing anything from. I assume they're all right.
Mm-hmm. A lot of propane needed to dry this year, though, I bet, huh?
Yes, and of course we knew that early, so most people were stocking up with their propane tanks, getting them filled earlier in the year, and that is often good advice. This year, of course, we didn't realize how low prices would go on gasoline or on propane.
Mm-hmm. We had that big spike in propane earlier in the year, but the prices settled down there?
They seem to have.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some other conditions that we want to think of in agriculture as we moved toward the colder months. I guess topsoil moisture, how are we doing there?
Topsoil is only a concern this time of year if you're out there harvesting. Oh, the third thing that I didn't mention on that, of course, was the plants. And if they were a bit soft because they'd had a bit of disease or something, it can make them so they're more susceptible to falling over or the crop ending up on the ground rather than in the bin. But other than that, the soil at the surface is not an important thing this time of year. If the surface is bone dry, of course, we get dust in the air. So we like enough moisture to keep the dust down, or material left in the fields to keep the dust down is even better. But that's about the only advantage. We only really need topsoil moisture when we are first planted and getting the crop out of the ground. After that, it's the subsoil moisture that counts.
All of our counties out of any drought conditions?
We're not seeing any drought reported on a countywide basis. I think there's still some dry places in fields. Of course, the counties up in the northwest part of the state that expect to be dry have been, they say, favorably dry now for the past couple of weeks. And as long as we're there, let's look at the crystal ball a bit.
Yes.
The outlook from the National Weather Service for the next 2 weeks is for warmer and drier than usual. Well, that's just perfect for harvest conditions. So that ushered in by the rains of this past week came a dry spell that looks like 2 weeks' duration. Take us right through the 30th of October with drier than usual conditions, slightly warmer than usual for this time of year. That doesn't mean it'll be hot, just warmer than usual, but that's good for the dry.
Oh, so it sounds like, Elwin, we can get out in the 50s and 60s during the day and enjoy the fall.
Well, we should be able to enjoy a pleasant fall the way things look right now. In the longer outlook, the latest El Nino report is the El Nino is very weak, but they don't think it is going away. And the report that came out from the National Weather Service for the winter is a moderate El Nino report, and that says that we expect this part of the Midwest to be about normal on moisture, the southern U.S. to be wet, the Northwest, Washington, Idaho, adjacent Canada, to be on the dry side and warm for the winter. Well, that's talking about a slight El Nino winter. The other good thing about El Nino winter, it doesn't have those extremes that we had this past winter when we had 9 polar outbreaks, or as it started to be called, breakdowns of the polar vortex. And so we're not expecting any more than 2 or 3 of those polar vortex events this winter. That would be normal.
Mm-hmm. And those polar vortexes, it matters how far that vortex dips down if it gets to Iowa or even further. Any indication there of how deep they will come out of Canada?
Not looking to be strong this year. That's a dangerous thing to say, though, because I remember back in the 70s when they were very strong and went down and killed many oranges in Florida and Texas and other citrus. And so, and this past winter, we had sort of repeated that. We don't expect to repeat this year.
Mm-hmm. I'm always fascinated, Elwin, when you talk about what's happening on the other side of the globe or out in the vast oceans affecting us here. And you mentioned El Nino. For those who don't quite understand what an El Nino year is, tell us what is happening thousands of miles away that causes our weather to be one way one year and another way another year.
Well, this is the thing that El Nino and La Nina, the opposite, do to us. It has to do with great temperature changes in the ocean. I mean, great, maybe 5 degrees, but that's big for a body of water like the ocean. And if we have a 5 degree warmer than usual water, then that warm air will tend to rise like air does. We call that a low pressure area. And if it's in an area that usually is high pressure, now we've got a low where a high usually is. The very strong La Nina we had for the past 4 years, really, up until this year, that brought us below normal crop yields across the U.S., was the second strongest La Nina that we have record of, mainly displacement of where the lows and highs are. Once they start being displaced, the great highs and lows around the equator, that displaces the ones next to them. Well, they're the ones that influence us directly. Whilst everyone is well aware that high pressure is often clear, dry weather, and low pressure tends to be associated with the stormy weather. And if the highs and lows are in opposite places, the weather has shifted.
Mm. Now, my 14-year-old and his friends are big snowboarders. Can you give them a good forecast for snow this winter, Elwin?
A lot of people are saying plan on some good snow events. It won't be a bitterly cold winter, but shouldn't be too hot. And if we get some snow falling, it might stay around. Then again, as I've been telling the people that have their snowmobiles, it's best to buy it with a trailer if you want to use it so you can take it up to Minnesota.
All right. Elwin Taylor, ISU climatologist and professor of ag meteorology. Always a pleasure to have you on the show. Keep that crystal ball in its cupboard or wherever you keep it for next time, Elwin.
It's always good to be with you. I wish you and everyone the very best.
All right. Elwin Taylor of Iowa State University. And finally today, right after I walk out of this studio, I walk a few blocks to downtown Iowa City where we have Iowa Public Radio's regular Friday afternoon Java Blend live music event beginning at 2 o'clock. Performances are recorded most Friday afternoons at the Java House in downtown Iowa City. It's open to the public. later broadcast to all of Iowa on our Studio One service. Here's a little taste of the band today that will be performing live, Hero Jr., an excerpt from the performance last time they were our guests. And suitably for the finish of this hour, it's called Bottom of the End.
I feel like the bottom of the end, and it is so deserved. Pick and snatch out a photograph that is warped in. I can't tell. Oh, Tom, won't you wake me? Tom, won't you take me? Tom, won't you help me get well? Tom, don't you waste me? Tom, don't you play me? It's time that I need to get well. After the tidal wave broke it, it's still a prayer. No.
Hero Jr., the band that will be playing in an Iowa Public Radio Studio One event at 2 o'clock this afternoon at the Java House in downtown Iowa City. River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend.
Stringing lights through a sheet pregnant.